Hi, everybody. Zach here. Just a brief program note. This is episode 17. Episode 16 will be released next week due to requirements from some additional editing on that episode.
Don't waste a second coding yet another login registration system. Use Product Structure to dynamically provide your site with turnkey solutions for user engagement, all through a single line of JavaScript. From registration to importing contacts to inviting friends, our products come with a built-in A/B testing engine to ensure you have the best methods to manage your users. Product Structure. Focus on your core application and let us serve you the rest.
All right, here we are with episode number 17 of Mostly Erlang, recorded on September 5th, 2013. And we're going to talk about RabbitMQ today. And we have on the line with us Alvaro, we have Alex, and we have Garrett. Would you all like to introduce yourselves?
Yep. My name is Alvaro. I'm mostly known as Old Sound in Twitter, a weird nickname. And I work with the Pivotal people at RabbitMQ, mostly as a developer advocate, but also contributing code from time to time or working in tools like the simulator and so on.
Okay, cool. And how about you, Alex?
Hi, I'm Alex Robson. I work for LeanKit. We produce a Kanban board that's great for work visualization. And we're looking at using Rabbit here, and I'm pretty excited about that. So very happy to be talking with you all today.
All right. And Garrett?
My name is Garrett Smith. I work for CloudBees. We are a Java platform as a service. We also do Jenkins hosting and provide enterprise services around Jenkins. Continuous integration. We use Rabbit fairly extensively, and I've been working with Rabbit probably for about 5 years now. So I've got some experience to talk about.
Okay, cool. And I'm Brian Hunter, out of Nashville, Tennessee, work for Firefly Logic, and I am guest hosting for Zach today. I put a Twitter question out, basically asking if anyone had any questions for the panel, and so I got a couple of smart alecks. I got Travis Smith, who says, "Why is RabbitMQ so awesome?" And then Chris Patterson says, "Because it's written in Erlang is not a valid answer." And so those two guys, it's interesting. They are the fellows, or at least part of the group behind Mass Transit, which is service bus written basically on top of RabbitMQ. Why don't you tell us what RabbitMQ is, Alvaro? Can you kind of tell us what the whole thing is at a high level? I mean, most people will have, you know, a lot of people on the podcast will actually have used it, but let's just go ahead and get our summary out of the way.
Okay, so the marketing line basically is messaging that just works. So RabbitMQ is a messaging system. It's made for interoperability between many platform languages and so on. Why it's so awesome, I don't know. I mean, I'm not the right guy probably to ask, because I would say it is, but for me, what got me into Rabbit was really simplicity back maybe 5 years ago in China when we started using it. And for me, it's great that it has a great community. There are tons of documentations. There are many books today. There are, I think 3 books talking about the server. There are clients in every language. I mean, not every language, but there is even COBOL and Delphi, for example. So you can get covered in almost any platform. And I like also that lately supports more than one protocol. So if AMQP, which was the original protocol, is too much for people, then now there are very lightweight options. So I think, yeah, there are a lot of options when it comes to using Rabbit, and that makes it very easy and cool to use, I think.
So you got this polyglot thing in there, which it's really great to have Alex on here, because I think he's sort of known as being this polyglot character. So this polyglot story, where I've mentioned RabbitMQ the most when I go around talking, when I'm talking to .NET developers, I say it's a pretty good way of introducing Erlang at your shop, because it gets, first of all, it gets your ops people comfortable with Erlang code that's been written well. And then secondly, it creates an option, instead of having like your big .NET assemblies being the middle of the world and then everything having to play by those rules, or using the database as the point of integration, it gives you a chance of having some other, maybe more wholesome thing be the point of integration. And so it's a way of being able to write the parts in Erlang that make sense and have those participate in the rest of, publish and subscribe. And then you're able to then have your queues with, you know, the rest, you know, your .NET stuff, your, you know, your C or whatever out there. And so that polyglot bit, I think, is really important. Would you have anything to jump in on that, Alex?
Yeah, actually, that's one of the reasons why we're looking at introducing it here at LeanKit. It is if you have homogeneous structure. So, you know, everything here right now is in .NET, but we'd like to take a look at using some other languages and some other tools. And one of the easier ways to do that in an existing architecture, in my experience, has been to introduce a tool like Rabbit. And you mentioned something earlier about getting ops folks comfortable. There's getting ops folks comfortable, and there's getting business, business owners comfortable with what it is you're introducing into their infrastructure. And one of the things I think that makes RabbitMQ awesome is that you can configure it to be pretty much lossless, right? So as you're taking away, I think you, had Brian, were the one that mentioned using the database as the point of integration. You're taking away the security blanket that, at least in the Microsoft stack, most people are very we're sort of trained to think that we have to have the database there. And until you put the data in Microsoft SQL Server, then it's not really safe, and you know, something bad could happen to it. So introducing something like Rabbit that is reliable and won't lose the messages and will allow us to retry if an entire service even falls over. I think there are a lot of big wins right out of the box that you can explain to even non-technical folks that they'll really understand and be comfortable with.
Right on. Now, Garrett, you have been off and using for 5 years, as you said, and you've had, I know you've used and had success with it, and then you've also hit things that, you know, you can see on the mailing lists, you know, where you're jumping in and helping. Then I've also heard you like grumble about things, and I just love to hear the whole mix, because you have, you know, real experience over a lot of time on big stuff, and I'd like to hear sort of the pros and cons that you've run into.
Yeah, I've also echo what's been said about Rabbit as a really nice strategic first step toward a couple of important things. I know this isn't answering your question, but I think it's worth underscoring, both to introduce different language or technical components. If you're homogeneous, to introduce at least the option of being heterogeneous, and also starting to take an important step toward distributed systems. This is a very turnkey messaging system that's very simple. AMQP is for as complex as the technical protocol is, sort of the user-facing protocol is fairly straightforward. It's a lot like email, and it gives programmers the ability to start to think in terms of services and distribution. And I think if we could get the world to think more in terms of distributed services and small and focused services, I think we could change everything. And if Rabbit, I think Rabbit's a great enabler for that. So, you know, we started out using Rabbit for that reason. I knew that we wanted to have, quote unquote, service oriented architecture, and not to sort of plug enterprise nomenclature there, but basically just the idea of looking at the functionality in your environment as services. So services have service levels, they've got well-defined interfaces, they're black boxes, you can use different languages to implement them. And when I looked at AMQP, it's like, this is the vision, that's what they're doing. They're doing an open protocol, open source stack protocol for this type of thing. And I thought, well, we'll just use that. So we actually started out with Cupid. I don't know if you're familiar with Cupid, but it's I'm not even sure how viable that is today. I haven't looked at it for a while, but moved off of it fairly quickly because of its complexity, and looked at Rabbit because it was fairly focused. I like the idea of having Erlang, at least having some experience. It was a good way for me to get experience with Erlang. I felt like this could be an interesting technology to bring in to the organization. So Rabbit kind of served as that. And as it turns out, it's such a high-quality piece of software that it just works. It is really, the message, the marketing message is true in my experience. It's messaging that just works. And then that did introduce Erlang. That was our sort of gateway drug into Erlang the language, which, of course, we now use extensively for all sorts of back-end services.
Wow. I had no idea about that. I asked you to be on here because I knew you'd worked with it a fair bit, but I didn't realize that was actually your intro into the language. That's really cool.
Yeah.
All right.
But, I mean, strangely, actually, personally, to learn Erlang, I've read the books, of course, but I literally printed the entire source code for Rabbit and read it. To see how a system could be built in this language. And I remembered sending a note out saying, I just can't believe how much is accomplished with so few. I mean, the stack of code I printed was very reasonable. Yeah. And I just read through it. I'm like, I can't believe it does all this stuff. And that's more of a testimony to Erlang, I think, than Rabbit. But it was a fun experience to start out with this thing.
You look in the source, so there's like, what is it, like 25 modules, and that's Rabbit.
Yeah.
Something shock. Like that. Yeah, it's amazing. And I've heard people talk about you know, their introduction to Erlang was digging through Couch, and then other people's experience was digging into Rabbit. And I've heard really good stories about the people that dug in. They learned Erlang by looking at Rabbit. It's a different story there, because I think it was, you know, built up front as, you know, much more idiomatic.
Yes, indeed.
And well, very cool. One thing you mentioned briefly, Alvaro, you mentioned just the one word, the word simulator. And this, I think, is a really great piece of software here. I don't know if I'll give just like the quick summary of what it is, and then you can talk about you actually built this piece of software, I understand. But yeah. it's basically a canvas where you can create the different elements of Rabbit. So you can create your producers and your exchanges, your queues and your consumers, and wire them together graphically and see how messages would flow from the left from your producers over to your consumers based on routing keys and based on binding keys and so on and the type of exchanges. And so it's funny. It makes me think back to Brett Victor's Inventing on Principle talk. It's this sort of two-way thing because it goes more than just being a canvas where you can see the simulating. You can actually import and export from a live running Rabbit install. Yeah. And so can you jump in and tell us a bit about like what led to it and how it's being used?
Yeah. So basically by giving talks everywhere, I was always showing like a slide where I say, okay, this is what ANQP does. We have three kind of exchanges with our actually routing algorithms, and this is how this exchange works, and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, people were like, okay, yeah, whatever, you know? And I thought, okay, I need something more visual, something that is easier to show, something that I can hook up live during the presentation, and I'm really showing people how routing and messaging works. So, okay, I started prototyping and I created this simulator. First, I did it on Raphael.js, and then I moved to processing because I felt it was more mature for that kind of particular task. And yeah, it started as a teaching tool, as something I wanted to use on my slides. Yeah, actually, I saw a presentation by Leah Veru, which mostly does CSS presentations, but the whole presentation she gave in a conference in Finland was a tool she built to demo CSS. So I said, okay, yeah, that's much better than just talking about CSS properties, right? Because she applied a property and you can see the thing working. She applied that transformation, and you can see this thing, the stuff moving and whatnot. So, okay, I got the inspiration there. I started working on the simulator. I got it working. But when I started demoing to my coworkers, I saw that it was even more than a teaching tool, that we can also, like, import stuff and then debug what was going on the server. We could design the topology and then export it directly into Rabbit and so on. So, yeah, it grew far, far more from what we expected when I started working on it. And I'm very happy that VMware back then let me experiment on that, like work until I got the concept, like that I was very fortunate, let's say, to be allowed to do this kind of research. And today it proved very useful for the company as well.
One of the things that was a surprise for me, I saw the video of the thing and I was all excited. I was like, man, this is so cool. And I went straight out and then I saw I had to install Node and I was like, oh. And so this is the first time that I'd installed Node, and I was willing to install Node because this is so cool. But this would be sort of a call to action to the people listening to this. I'm sure that Alvaro would love to get a pull request for someone that had ported the web front of this to Cowboy or Web Machine or heck, iNets or anything. You know, if someone do a port, go ahead, Alvaro. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, I use Node basically. I mean, please censor this part of the podcast, but it's just a necessary evil, basically. So it's very easy to tell people just install Node and run this app, then get the whole Erlang stuff running. So for what, it's sad to have to say this, but I find installing Node is very like download next. I agree next, and then it's there. While to install Erlang, maybe today is easier with the Erlang solution packages, but still it's too foreign for people. Like, for example, we have business people that today they are using the simulator to show how Rabbit works. So for them to make them do the whole setup will be maybe too much. That's the only reason I'm using Node. If I will have a very easy to deploy Erlang, I wouldn't even care.
One of the things, you know, since the source itself is written in, so you're talking about if you're headless, like if you want to show the simulator without actually having Rabbit around, right, is why you do why you have, but if you have a Rabbit install handy, of course you have also Erlang there, and so
exactly. So yeah, if you, one thing I want to do in the future, but it's not a high priority now, is to have the simulator as a plugin. So when you when you run Erlang, I mean, Rabbit is using Web Machine, right, for the management API.
Okay.
So I could serve the whole simulator through Web Machine. I mean, that wouldn't be difficult or anything.
Okay. Well, that's the call to action then. So
exactly.
If anyone, so ping Old Sound on Twitter, if you're interested in taking that project on or pairing up with him, I'm sure that this would be a fun thing. To create a plugin, and I'd love to see that. I'd love to be the beneficiary of having that out there. So please.
Yeah, since it really the Node part is just there for mostly for nothing.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
One of the things you mentioned just then about the install process, and of course it varies by platform. You know, for Erlang, but Erlang is actually quick to set up on Windows. But interestingly, RabbitMQ is I think probably the most. It's incredibly simple to set up Rabbit on Windows. This is one of the things where this software just shines. From my background, as you look at the thing, there's an installer. It just works. It's all beautiful. There's no funky sort of. Everything just plays nicely, and you then go off and look at the docs. It looks all professional. So. That side of it, that polish, that professional, that deployment side, can you tell us how that happened? I mean, of course, I think you mentioned, you know, VMware in the role, but was VMware there from, how did all that happen and how did it evolve?
So actually the whole Rabbit was before VMware, most of it, even I think the Windows installers and so on, before VMware acquired RabbitMQ.
Okay.
The team, surprisingly, is today is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people. And it's been like that since always, around 6 people working on Rabbit, from the documentation to the installers. Sorry. The installers, the source code, everything is done by 4 or 5 engineers. And yeah, they have a really high standard when it comes to code. I know because I contributed code there, and from
I think it's fair to call them brilliant engineers. That would help people understand why there's just 5 of them.
Yeah,
no, they really are. I mean, the team behind this code base is really exceptional, and I say that even within you know, sort of exceptional spheres. They're quite talented. That's why I think, you know, when we, it's very easy to say messaging that just works, but this is a technical, very complex problem to solve, especially in edge cases. And this group is really enjoyable to work with and watch their process, because it's all open source. Of course, you can see the decisions unfold and the discussions, etc. And it's I think it's a marquee project in the entire open source community. How's that for a plug?
That's a good one. A question I have about it comes down to versioning. When you are using, you know, you have code and you have your database, upgrading is always tricky between syncing your database and your code up, making sure that everything plays nice. And you then add this third piece in of queues. Does that end up making things more complicated? Does it make things less complicated? What's the story there as far as like versioning? Like we have a bit additional bits of topology, or we have changes in messages, that sort of thing.
The way that I've approached this in the past, there certainly could be better approaches, but the way we've done this in the past is the message header carries a version number. And the dispatcher that we have in any given language sitting on top of the RabbitMQ client is actually passing that message off to a handler that knows how to process that particular message version. In my opinion, that's a pretty straightforward way to handle support for multiple versions, since the message handlers themselves are usually quite simple. So I found that to be a relief versus how I've had to do versioning in the past with architectures that were, you know, in a statically typed system that were, you know, it was tightly coupled, and then you had to worry about, like you mentioned, the database migrations as well, since everything talked to the database.
That's an interesting thing. Even the heterogeneous side, you could maybe have a message that is upgraded on the .NET side, but not on the Erlang side, and is on the Python side, or, you know, so it gets interesting in that way as well.
A lot of people are using Thrift and Protobuf to deal with that. So your payload, your binary encoding and decoding at the payload level can have versions, and so it becomes decoupled from your messaging system. But you know, you can use headers, etc., just to flag things. But I think it also goes, you know, this sort of static versus dynamic type problem. It goes to a lot. I think that's why JSON is a fairly popular payload, so you can pull things out selectively. If they're not there, they're not there. It's, you know, you don't have to bind that tightly to your data structure. So I think those things are the mix when it comes to solving this problem. I don't think it's as big a, doesn't seem quite as big a problem as database, because relational databases, of course, are very picky about everything, and versioning becomes critical to get right.
Oh, the other thing I would mention really quickly too is, and I'd like to hear from Garrett and Alvaro, you know, because certainly the way that one person does their rabbit topology doesn't mean that that's the only way. But I've actually never had to change my topology based on a change in versioning, which I thought was awesome, because, you know, it was one less thing that I had to worry about. So I thought it was nice that applications could be resilient in terms of how a consumer might be handling different message versions. It didn't actually require me to change my topology.
I mean, the great thing about a router, in this case, a broker, a hub and spoke model, and in particular something like the MQP topic exchange, fan out as well, is that you can remove client consumers and plug them back in. I mean, that's the benefit of the messaging architecture. And so I think it almost just goes away, the idea of just being able to broadcast something to a logical endpoint, have a consumer pull that off, either one or many or none, and then deal with that. It's a really nice – that's when I say, you know, this is a gateway into distributed systems. Once you start to get into this, I think lots of traditional problems where the database is the center of the universe and becomes very brittle, they just completely go away. The whole point of this is to become flexible and pluggable. And that's, you know, Alex, that's been my experience as well. We haven't changed our topology at all. I mean, we could talk a little bit about moving outside of Rabbit into some other messaging technology. There, the topology tends to move around a lot. But I think the benefit of Rabbit is that it's AMQP at its core. And AMQP, for its complexity, is a fairly well-reasoned messaging protocol or schema. It's a set of patterns. When you use that, I think you get all these benefits, and it tends not to change. I haven't changed much at all.
Hmm. That's good. Those are good stories here. Alvaro, so far out of the conversation, is there anything that's popped up that you'd like to pitch out to us?
No, I mean, when I was reading this book, The Enterprise Integration Patterns, it has a big name, but it's actually a very cool book about messaging. Yeah, they have versioning or a type on the message, which AMQP also supports on the headers of the message. And a pattern that I saw that is pretty cool from that book is that both the producer and the consumer in the Microsoft MQ, there is a field where you can set up what's the decoder and what's the encoder of a message. And I think that in AMQP terms can be translated to the content type header of a message. And doing some things there or even maybe abusing that field, you can get to solve this problem of versioning and whatnot. And also what I really like from that book is another pattern, which is the control bus, which you can have consumers in Rabbit, and also those consumers can be listening to a topic exchange from this control bus, and you can send them messages and tell them upgrade yourself, or now instead of decoding with this library, decode with this one, or the database configuration change, now connect here or there. So as Garrett said, I think all the distributed stuff that you learn when you start doing messaging, I think is really cool. And yeah, to be able to think in those terms now, like, okay, I have a consumer, then I can lively upgrade Erlang style, let's say, to tell it, like the example from Joe Armstrong, like you have an area server that then becomes I don't know what server. And with the control pattern, you can have your consumers also being able to lively upgrade, saying, handle the logic this way now, use this decoder for data, and so on. I think that's pretty cool and advanced also.
The word distributed has popped up a few times here. And how does Rabbit distribute? So if you have more load, or you want to make sure that if a bomb hits one server that Rabbit's running on, how do you cluster, and how does that story work, and what happens when, like a server does catch on fire that's running Rabbit?
So if the server catch on fire, stay away. No, I mean, there are many solutions. At the beginning, Rabbit had like vanilla Erlang distribution, basically, or out of the box. So the problem with AMQP, or the way the queues work in Rabbit, is they are local to the server where you declare them. So a plain Erlang distribution will distribute the name of the queues, or I mean the resources, but not the contents. So if you have a first version cluster, you just have that you can access your queues from every server you connect to, but the contents will still live in the original server where the queue was declared. That, of course, is suboptimal. And now with highly available queues, the queues are mirrored to all the nodes that you say they should be mirrored. And there you start having this that you can load balance. And another way that is pretty cool is there is an exchange type called consistent hashing, which it does that. You can bind the queues to the exchange, and they will be load balanced with this algorithm. So, yeah, you can distribute the queues specifically declare the queues in one broker. So, you know, it's living in, let's say, Rabbit A, and then you declare another queue in Rabbit B, both bound to the same exchange, let's say logs or images. And then this exchange will load balance the messages, for this queue. So there are many options, I think.
Okay. So and that the last scenario you're talking, you is it fully no masters? Are they all equal peers?
Yeah, you can have all equal peers, and even you can go further to say, so let's say you have three rabbits. Mm-hmm. When you declare an exchange in one of them, the exchange will be available in all of them, right?
Okay.
Then you declare a queue in one of, let's say, rabbit A. The queue contents will live there. So if that server catches fire, then of course the messages will be gone. I mean, that's, there is no magic here.
Right? Okay. All right.
Erlang still doesn't have fairies.
No fairies? Is that what you said? Yeah.
Yeah, that's bad part about the Swedish mythology. There are no fairies. Anyway, so then on rabbit B, you declare another queue for the same messages and bounded to the exchange, and the same on rabbit C. So you will have three queues. And when the messages are published to either of those three servers, it will be routed with this consistent hashing to one of the queues.
Okay. Now,
then, if you want highly available queues, you can also replicate those queues. But you are sure that there is a load balance of messages between the queues.
Okay.
You so, follow the...
Yeah, I'm trying to figure then what happens, like, you know, temporary partitions. Like, how do things catch up? And it's getting me thinking about, we had a conversation in Oslo about this for just a minute. And so, about React and React Core and how they handle, you know, with their ring. And then, you were talking a bit about Rabbit. I'd love everyone to get a chance to hear, that if you remember the conversation.
Yeah, I don't remember the conversation.
There are a lot of conversations I don't remember from there.
It was two in the north, you know?
Yeah, two in the north, right.
Yeah. I mean, the difference between React, I mean, I always been thinking, like, why we don't use React Core for Rabbit? But the problem is that in RabbitMQ, they have to be highly consistent because Rabbit doesn't want to send duplicates to clients. So in the way the Rabbit does clustering, mm-hmm. it has to be able to replicate information about who consumed what and who published what to all the other nodes on the system. That's why they have their own way of electing a master and so on. When you do highly available queues, there will be always a master queue, and then there will be slaves. And then there are strategies on how the slaves will become master in the case of a partition. There's auto-healing, and there's everything on fire mode, basically. But
go ahead.
I just wanted to ask a quick follow-up question. So is it that you can't have consumers on both the master and the slave? Is that how they prevent multiple clients getting copies of the same message?
So the idea is that clients should not get the same message twice. I mean, that it should go to only one. That's the ideal case. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, it shouldn't happen in practice, but yeah, I mean, the as far as I know, to practice there's a distance. But the theory with Rabbit or NQP is to not deliver duplicate messages. That's why Rabbit requires high consistency between the nodes in the cluster.
So you're saying there's coordination between clustered nodes so that if I have a master queue and a slave queue and a highly available pairing, if a message gets issued off one of the queues, it effectively is being issued off the other as well in coordination.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, that's the deal. I mean, ideally, there should be the less network partitions as possible. I mean, that's the ideal world, of course. I mean, everybody knows that's not the case. But yeah, that's the problem with high consistency.
What do you all use in Rabbit? Are you using someone else's, or do you have your own that we could steal in other apps as far as for leader election? Do you know inside of the code what's
that's all part of the Rabbit code.
Okay, all right, so just dig in there. And
I don't know if you've been following, but I've been posting like probably four blogs in a row now since last week, all about the Rabbit internals, and I'm digging through the code to surface this stuff out to the community. So okay. People have a reference where to look when they want to implement this or that. Or, I mean, there are many cool Erlang patterns, let's say, inside the Rabbit code, from pattern matching, I mean, ways to use pattern matching. Yesterday, I published how to validate behaviors. So there are many things I've been surfacing, and I, my idea is also to get into the leader election and all the stuff that Rabbit is doing to okay. document that.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely get a link to that blog series along with the show notes. That'll be really cool. Now, how far along in that process are you? How many posts are you into it?
I'm 4 so far.
Okay, cool. Cool. As you're in there, there have been a few posts I've seen over the summer by Chris Michaeljohn about PG2 and GPROC and leader election there. And this would be interesting to if you dug into that and then you explained in the context of those, like how, you know, Rabbit goes about it, that'd be a really neat thing to tie into that series there.
Yeah, there are some. There is, I'm just looking at the code. There is PG, then there is PG2 fixed. Like, if you know from Erlang, you probably heard already about Gen Server 2. Yep. Gen Server 2 comes from the RabbitMQ source code. It's part of React and many others, but there are lots of those libraries.
And they're a little different too. I suggested that the gen server should be hashed. It should be gen server AB12, depending on the company. Because everyone picks 2, and then, of course, there's collisions when you have to combine them. It's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, the Rabbit gen server 2 has had many fixes along the time. So.
Hop in there, Garrett. You've been quiet here for a few minutes.
Well, this is an interesting topic. So I kind of I've steered away from some of these more. I haven't actually kept up to date with some of these new features. I didn't even know, for example, about consistent hash exchanges. I think that's outside the AMQP spec, unless that's also changed. So it sounds like that might be a Rabbit. Is that a Rabbit specific exchange?
AMQP allows to define new exchanges as part of the specification.
Yes, so, why does that not surprise me?
a new exchange should be prefixed with the X. So X dash exchange type. There are many exchanges, actually, new ones. There is like the last value cache exchange. I created an exchange called recent history exchange, which the exchange keeps track of the last X messages that went around the exchange. Mm. So whenever there is a new queue subscribed, that queue will get those X messages. That can be used for a chat, for example. When you join a room, you want to know what happened, and you can get the last messages.
That's nice. Yeah.
That's one of the exchanges. Then there is the random exchange, which is just uses random load balancing, basically. Then, of course, this consistent hashing. There are more.
And so there is
one exchange to put the data that goes through the exchange to React. So there are many. And that's part of the protocol to extend it, basically.
Yep.
And how would you add? How would you go in and say add random exchanges to your out of the box, you know, just installed from the web version of RabbitMQ? What would you have to do to get random exchanges added in?
Okay, so RabbitMQ has a very advanced plugin architecture, and I will say it's one of the most cool part of the source code. Okay. How they did to support plugins. So basically, I mean, of course, you need to download the Rabbit source code, and you will compile your exchange against the source code. I mean, if you want to create one yourself, then you need to follow a behavior and so on. I mean, like normal Erlang stuff. And then the Rabbit compiler will create a zip file, basically. That zip file, you distribute it, and then your users will put it inside the plugins folder, and then you can enable the plugin, disable the plugin, and so on. And when Rabbit boots, when the broker starts, it will scan the plugins and we will enable all of them. And if there is an exchange, it will register the exchange type. Actually, I talked about this in the last two blog posts of this series I'm mentioning. That's it. Then the new exchange type is available. Hmm. That's the high-level way of seeing how it's done. The cool part is how Rabbit actually implemented the plug-and-play architecture. That's pretty advanced, I think.
Cool. Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks.
I know it used to be that the plugins were just Erlang OTP applications. Is that sounds like that's been significantly changed.
They're not really OTP apps. It's just, yeah, I mean, you have the app and you have the module that implement the exchange. That's basically it. So RabbitMQ has a system called the Rabbit Boot system, which is very similar on how an operating system starts. So
you're not just redescribing the Erlang init, because this is the way Erlang works.
No, I'm not redescribing Erlang.
Okay.
So
just checking, because like being able to dynamically plug in new things, disable them, etc. is all, that's the way OTP applications work.
Yeah, but no, it's not that.
Okay,
just checking. The Rabbit Boot system, basically what it does is like with via module declarations, you declare a new module, a new declaration saying module attribute, sorry, that's the word. A new attribute when you say the name of the attribute is Rabbit Boot, and then with a tuple, you say this attribute depends of this thing having run before and this other thing, and it will enable blah, blah, blah. For example, you cannot start the database if the file system cache that RabbitMQ has, like a file system handle cache, is not running. Or you cannot start listening to network connections if all the exchanges are not available. But to have the exchanges available, you first need to have the Rabbit registry available. The Rabbit registry is just like a map that keeps track of all the exchanges, all the authentication types, and so on that Rabbit supports. So when you have all these Rabbit Boot attributes, it's hard to explain with words. It's easier with code. But basically, you're telling the Rabbit registry to register your exchange type, which is exposes this type like X consistent hash, and the implementation is in this module. So the way this is plug and play is like when Rabbit boots, it will scan all the modules for this attribute called Rabbit Boot. It will be built a direct acyclic graph on it, so to make sure all the dependencies can be satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say this depends on blah, that there is nothing circular there. And if this exchange enables blah, that also there is not a circular dependency. And when this is satisfied, then it goes through this graph and start calling each function like network or file system hash cache start, Rabbit registry start, Rabbit registry register exchange, Rabbit registry register authentication type, and so on and so forth. It goes all over those steps and then it boots. So the way it works is like you just drop your plugin in the plugin folder. RabbitMQ will see which plugins are enabled and then we'll just scan the module for whatever they are trying to register or provide, basically. I mean, I have also a documentation about that online, so it's easier to go there.
Yep. Now, Rabbit, is it using Erlang's built-in distribution stuff, or is it handling that itself? So is it basically just doing off the equivalent of a netAD and ping, and you're using the Erlang port mapper daemon, or is it using its own layer and talking sockets? Because I know I've heard quite a few people doing distributed things are just rolling their own, and I find that interesting. And it's also curious, like with Rabbit, what's going on there?
So as far as I know, it's using default distribution, but okay. I haven't been diving there so much on my own. But
and just to clarify what we're talking about, this is the standard distributed Erlang feature set. When you start Erlang as a node, it connects via a mesh network and then allows all nodes to communicate sort of seamlessly within the Erlang environment. Is that's when you say standard distribution? This is what you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well. Cool. Okay. And I was pretty sure that answer was yes, because I'd seen the Erlang port mapper daemon show up like on threads about Rabbit in the past. And so I thought, okay, well they're using, you know, they're kind
Rabbit,
of,
Rabbit killing it on uninstall on certain OS packages. That was a fun one to track down.
Yeah.
This is one of the single dependency. This is one of sort of a problem with Erlang is it has this dependency on this port mapping daemon that gets sort of started up lazily. And when you have multiple Erlang applications on a system, on a server instance, they're all kind of vying for the service. And some of the packages would actually uninstall and end up terminating this, which would, of course, kill all of your distributed Erlang stuff. So it was an interesting surprise.
Yep.
I'm sure that's been fixed a long time ago.
Yeah, that was actually exactly the story I was wanting to ferret out of that. That's why I headed down there. So I was happy to hear that we got there.
And that's really not Rabbit's. That's not Rabbit's fault. That's a bizarre design decision.
Found a bug inside the Erlang. I mean, I can't say I could find a bug in Erlang because for Unix systems like Mac, for example, and pretty sure also in Linux, but I don't remember exactly, the Erlang port mapper or the Erl exec should be in a folder without spaces, which usually in Linux or Unix, you don't have spaces in folders, but in the Mac, you do. So when I was doing the standalone release for Rabbit, I had everything there. I created the release and blah, blah, blah. And then I was running it, and I was getting all these errors. And then thanks to Dtrace, I could find that it was really, really into the Erlang code. And then I could send the bug report and so on. But, yeah, I mean, I didn't want to make a fool of myself saying there is a bug in Erlang. But, yeah, found it.
One thread that comes up a lot of times is about back pressure. Like between call and cast with Rabbit, so you would have you just keep on throwing things at it until your Rabbit falls down, right? Because it's fire forget.
Okay. Actually, this got fixed. Okay, I don't know what was the module, but basically Rabbit now has a credit system.
Okay.
So every process that sends messages will have a credit of how many it can send and so on. So, yeah, it's all prevented. In previous pre 2.8 versions of Rabbit, I guess, that was not the case. You could literally kill a broker if you really, really smash it with messages.
Because
all the process queues will start to back up and so on. But that's today's fix with the message flow system, like a credit system. I also plan to document that on this series.
Okay, cool.
Has that required an update on all the clients? So client code would have to be modified to support that, I assume.
So in the new version of Rabbit, the 3.1.5, I think there will be an alert sent to the client.
That was fixed when?
No. So the credit flow system was introduced, I think, on the 2.8 version. But your client, when Rabbit reached the flow, the threshold, then it will block your client and will not allow it to publish any more messages, basically.
Okay.
You can then drain the queues, and at some point it will start up again. That's the thing. And in the new version, which will be released soon, I don't know exactly when, the 3.1.5, that version will have a system to notify consumers or publishers that they are being blocked that these alarms were raised. I don't exactly know the details because lately there are a couple of new alarms that Rabbit is firing when any of these states are reached. So I'm not exactly sure which one, but I know in the new version there will be more notification for clients in that regard.
And I have another big one to pitch in there, and just the word security.
Who was the question?
It's just a general thing to throw out there. Like, what's the security story?
So what Rabbit provides out of the box is you can do SSL authentication. And then also there is a new thing that when you publish a message, you can also use the header called user ID, which it has to be the same user ID as the user that is logged in into the connection. Unless that user has special privileges, but by default, if you set the user ID, you have to be the same user that logged in, that started the connection. So that makes that a consumer knows that if the message has a particular user ID, it's for sure sent by that user. So you have like default SSL authentication. There are also new authentication methods because that also you can write your own plugins. So okay. You can do HTTP authentication if you have some service that does that. I know some people were writing an LDAP or LDAP plugin for Rabbit. And yeah, there are many ways to authenticate your users. And apart from that, there is this protection on the user ID if you set that.
Okay, so you'd be able to lock down and say, I'm only going to allow these folks to consume from this queue. I'm going to only allow these folks to publish to this exchange.
Can do that also. So each user has a set of permissions that say it has read, write access to this queue or this exchange or this virtual host. Also that all the queues and exchanges belong to a certain virtual host. So if your user doesn't have access to that virtual host, then it doesn't have access to those queues and exchange. That's another part. So if you are, for example, selling RabbitMQ hosting, you can separate user per virtual host, and there is no way they will do it. I mean, they will access the other guy messages.
Could you explain to us the idea of a virtual host?
Okay, so a virtual host is just like probably a concept similar to the one in Apache where you divide resources per host. So in Rabbit, each exchange has this virtual, I don't know how to say that in English, but this virtual host where it belongs to, the same for a queue, and every resource on the broker will be subdivided into virtual hosts. And so, by using pattern matching, whenever you open a connection, you are connecting also to a virtual host inside Rabbit. By default, there is the / virtual host, but you can have any amount of virtual host.
So this would be like we've got one Rabbit server, and we just want to have multiple environments, and these are all going to be totally separate from each other. And so we could have the same topology for like dev and QA and staging and so on, or just have different topologies if we just had different teams working on the same Rabbit server, right? Yeah,
that's a better explanation. That's what I did. But okay. That's the how it works. And this is also in this series I've been documenting Rabbit. Something cool from Erlang is that Erlang, when you do pattern matching on the function header, you can have the same variable twice. So the first time the variable will be bound, and the second time it has to be exactly what was before, right? Mm. So because every resource in Rabbit belongs to a virtual host, let's say when you publish a message, you publish the message into a virtual host. Let's say virtual host A. And you send the message to an exchange that belongs to a certain virtual host. So when the routing is done, via pattern matching on the route function, they are just checking the virtual host that they match. So there is no way a user that has access to virtual host A will publish messages into virtual host B. Just the Erlang pattern matching won't allow that. So that's very cool.
That is cool. Yep. I heard a story on this is an Erlang factory from 2012. This is really just a kind of a crazy project, but I love the story. It's so Brett Cameron. Do you all know him? Are you familiar with Brett Cameron?
Yeah.
Okay. So he basically ported Erlang to HP's OpenVMS. And the reason behind it was he wanted to have Rabbit on OpenVMS. I just think it's such an interesting thing where Rabbit ends up being the sort of ambassador for the language. I think there's a lot for us to learn just from it as on the business side of the thing, as far as, you know, it gets Garrett into Erlang. It's like, I wonder how many people are Erlang developers because of Rabbit and that whole deployment story, just the how solid it is. It's just, hats off. Do you all have things to throw out before we jump into our pick of the week? I'm guessing
Silence means no. All right. So if we're exhausted now, the announcement I have, I'm hoping that this episode will air before it's too late. But Erlang Camp, Nashville, there are still tickets available and a few tickets available. And so it'd be great to have you all come down to Nashville, Tennessee on October 11th and 12th. So it's hard to have a better thing to level up on Erlang than Erlang Camp. So if you're getting started, it's a good one. My pick of the week would be to go off and look at Alvaro's simulator. And I'll have a link to that. It's just a beautiful thing to see in action, and it explains Rabbit. He has a video that goes along with it on Vimeo, I think. It's like a 10-minute video, and it clears up as much as a book would. And, of course, Alvaro also wrote the book. The Manning book. And so that'll be my second pick of the week, is go off and grab that book as well. How about you? I'll put you on the spot. Alex, do you have any pick of the week?
Yeah, I've actually been digging into a couple of things. One of them is this idea of a hypertext application language, which for folks who like REST and are familiar with what Hadios is, it's a really interesting way to provide a somewhat self-documented API to the client. And this relates to Erlang because I've been looking at potentially building a HAL-compliant API on top of ELLI, E-L-L-I, which is a very lightweight Erlang HTTP server that I actually like, since sadly Miss Sultan went away. They have some similarities in how they're laid out conceptually. So those are things I've been digging into.
Cool. How about you, Garrett? What have you been reading this week?
I'm going to check this ELLI out. What's it called? ELLI?
ELLI, I think.
ELLI. Yeah. All right. Well, that's not my pick. But so I've got to promote also. We have, if you're in the Chicago area on October 4th, we've got an Erlang Factory Lite plan for that day. So that's a full day, 8 sessions, great speakers. We're going to be doing deep dives on scalability, concurrency, reliability. So basically featuring folks from Concurrent. Alex Gunnars is going to be speaking. Adam Denenberg from Huffington Post will be there. Corey Haynes will be talking about his experience with actually using Elixir. So there's a bunch of other speakers. So it's great. If you're going to be in Chicago October 4th, check it out. ChicagoErlang.com is the website.
Cool.
So my pick would be, I've been using this library for a while, but it's been greatly improved since I first started using it. It's called Erlport, spelled the way it sounds, E-R-L-P-O-R-T. And it's a library that lets you build external ports, which are essentially little servers that programs that act as servers to Erlang processes in Python and in Ruby. And I've been using it when I can't do something in Erlang or can't do it well. And often this comes down to trying to interface with other libraries or databases. Or Python and Ruby both have sort of the de facto standard high-quality library interfaces. And what I'll do is I'll create a little program, a port, and this little this bridge library, Erlport, will let me communicate from Erlang to this other program. Uh-huh. And I've used it a lot, and it's been improved tremendously. So if anyone's interested in how can I sort of break out of Erlang in a high-quality way using well-designed patterns, Erlport, and implementing your things in Python or Ruby, Erlport is something to look at.
That's really cool. Yeah. And how about you, Alvaro?
So I'm kind of sorry for being kind of self-referential, but what I've been doing the last week was just diving into Rabbit code and writing this blog post about things I found inside. And if I can say an announcement next week, because I'm in the States now for a month, next week I will be speaking about Rabbit in the San Francisco offices of Pivotal Lab. And then the day after, I will be also in the Bay Area talking about Rabbit. So if anybody wants to join or go or meet or have a beer, I will be around. So.
Well, cool. Well, this has been a really good conversation. I've learned a ton from you all. Thanks for being on there.
So big thanks to you for having us in the podcast.
All righty. Well, good stuff. Thank you all.
Thanks.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.